Welcome to the Weird History Podcast. I'm Joe Strecker. This is an independent, ad-free, listener-supported podcast. To become a supporter, go to weirdhistorypodcast.com. Hello, everyone. Today, we have an interview with a great friend of the program, Bill Lasher. He has been on this podcast twice before. Once to talk about his first book, Eve of 100 Midnights, and a second time to talk about his second book, The Golden Fortress. And he is here a third time to talk about his third book, A Danger Shared. I really enjoyed this conversation. It touched on one of my favorite periods of history, which is Asia during World War II. Not the Pacific Theater, not the U.S. island hopping or anything, but actually things on the Asian continent itself and, you know, actions that happened among various Asian combatants in World War II. I don't think we talk about that enough, at least not in the English-speaking world, but it was huge. Like, World War II was a world war, and the Philippines and the like saw, well, all kinds of atrocities and horribleness. But anyway, Bill approaches that time through the lens of something very personal to him, a journalist named Melville Jacoby, and we'll get into his relationship with that journalist in the interview. If you are in Portland, he is doing an event on March 30th at the Rose City Book Pub. So if you want to see him in person, talking about his book, promoting his book, and also I think he would sell you a copy and probably sign it, check that out on the 30th. I really enjoyed this conversation. I hope you will too. Here's Bill. Bill Lasher, hello.
Hello, how are you, Joe?
Doing great. Thank you so much for coming by. We are actually in the same room, which is a rarity for interviews.
It is. What an honor to be in your presence.
The honor is all mine. Yeah, thank you for coming back to talk about your third book. Normally, when I interview somebody for this podcast about a book they've written, I read it first.
Mm-hmm.
This time, I'm going in cold.
Mm-hmm.
So I have only a little bit of an idea about what's in there. Like, what's in there? What is it? What is this project?
Well, the good thing is you won't have to read too much because it's a collection of photos by the journalist Melville Jacoby, who was the subject of my first book, Eve of 100 Midnights, which I believe you read and you had me on this show for.
Yes.
So you kind of know the gist of who he was and what he took, but it's essentially, I don't know, about 300 previously unpublished photos that he took while covering the war, World War II in Asia from roughly 1939 to 1942, although he first went to China in 1937. So some pictures from that period, too.
Okay. Eve of 100 Midnights was published in 2016, correct?
Correct.
Yeah. So for listeners who maybe need a little bit of a refresher or didn't hear the previous episode where you talked about it or haven't read the book, could you give us a little encapsulation of what that's about and who Melville Jacoby was?
Sure. Mel was a, like I said, he was a journalist during World War II, an American from Southern California, who first went to China as an exchange student in the academic year of 1936 to 1937, kind of became fascinated with the country and sort of as a aside with the way that Asia was portrayed in the United States, having been there as a student and then coming back home to see sort of the exotification and dramatization of the cultural differences that he experienced. He had been there right when the Sino-Japanese War started after Japan and China went to war. In the summer of 1937, Mel was traveling around. So he came back home to coverage of this war and realized that the coverage was like a little bit different than what he'd experienced. And that sort of set him on a mission to become a journalist, first of all, and second of all, to become a journalist focused on Asia and particularly China. So he went back as a reporter after he finished his school and became a freelance reporter, then quickly moved to the Chinese wartime capital of Chongqing. And worked as sort of a stringer for a variety of American publications and then also as a propagandist for the Chinese national, the then Chinese national government's like wartime information service, doing English language broadcasts of material being sent home to the U.S. And he didn't like the fact that it was kind of propaganda work, so sort of moved from that to regular journalism, covered the sort of brewing aspects of the conflict that were happening in what is now Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia, but was a French colonial possession at the time. And got in a bit of hot water there, came back to the U.S., and then went one more time to become a reporter and to work as a reporter for this time for Time and Life magazine, and ended up being in the Philippines when the U.S. and Japan went to war, when Japan attacked Pearl Harbor, but also Manila and other allied locations throughout the Pacific. And so that book is about that whole experience of Mills, that development, and at the same time about his romance with another journalist named Annalee Whitmore, who Mel proposed to and married in Manila just before Pearl Harbor. And so the two of them fled the Japanese because of the critical reporting they'd done about the war, together with a couple other reporters and some other people, and sort of sailed through the Philippines and across the Pacific through enemy waters and finally to safety. And so that story is told there. It's sort of Eve of 100 Midnights is more the story of Mel, of that romance, of the sort of adventures that he and Annalee had together, against that historical backdrop. This book is more about what Mel saw as a journalist, and it's less about him, although I set it up a bit, and more a presentation of this unbelievable photography he produced while working as a reporter.
How did you get a hold of these photographs?
Well, what I didn't mention in describing Eve of 100 Midnights was that Mel Jacoby was my grandmother's cousin. And when I was in my 20s and starting my career as a journalist, she gave me a typewriter that belonged to Mel. And she said, here, you should have this. It's from my cousin, the war correspondent. And over the years, told me Mel Jacoby's story, unveiled all these little aspects of his life, and then showed me these boxes and boxes and cartons and all sorts of other containers full of negatives, prints, you know, magazines with prints, articles, typewriter things, letters, correspondence of Mel's that she'd ended up with when his mother passed away in the early 80s. And she just knew that someone would want to tell a story. I ended up telling that story, and then had all these materials as after I worked on Eve of 100 Midnights, thinking I'm going to make a sort of coffee table book type thing. I had used them as promotion for my first book, a couple of them, but not nearly the vast majority. So at some point, I took them up to Portland from California, where she lived, and digitized them, scanned them, and made sense of them.
What was something that maybe surprised you, or something that you learned when you were going through his photographs and documents? What jumped out?
Well, what I don't know if I was quite say surprised by, but what I was impressed by and what I noticed was I had always thought of him as a writer and a radio broadcaster. His work that he was known for in the U.S. was his writing and his radio work. Although there's one set of his photos that became very famous from the Philippines. But to realize how interested in photography he was and how much he had captured throughout that period and developed as a photographer. If you were to look through these photos, and it kind of appears in my book because it's presented somewhat chronologically, you see this development of a photographer learning that skill, learning the craft, deciding what to take pictures of. So that's one thing. The other thing that is really notable to me that I wasn't able to get into in as much depth in Eve of 100 Midnights was how much happened in present-day Vietnam, but what was then known as French Indochina, that was sort of consequential to the war and the trajectory of the war.
Okay.
And how much it kind of complicated sort of the history of the war with this idea that there were some tensions between the French forces that were colonial, you know, occupiers there, and then the Japanese forces, and the relationship between the Japanese and the Nazis having occupied France, and how that mattered, but the fact that there were other European and North American, you know, U.S. operating in Vietnam at the time, because they were not at war with Japan. And he took, in looking at the photos, I'd think the bulk of the not personal photos that he took, there's probably more of China, but the next batch is just an unbelievable number of material of prints and items from Vietnam. I guess one reason for that, though, and I'm only thinking of this now when I say that, is that at the risk of spoiling things, mm-hmm. He came home from that stint in Vietnam, stopped home for a few months and brought all his work home, and then went back to Asia and never made it back to California when he went back to Asia. Mm-hmm. And there were reasons when he had to flee the Japanese and the Philippines, he had to ditch a lot of his work that he hadn't already sent home by mail or other couriers. So I do wonder, maybe he had more photography that never made it across that could have been used. But the fact that there was a sort of push into Asia by way of what was then called French Indochina by Japan was really fascinating to me as someone who kind of hears the story of the war as, we don't even really hear in the West the story of the war in Japan and between Japan and China prior to the U.S. entry into the war in 1941. And so that's already a surprise, but I knew about that at this point. But looking through the photos to realize even that was far more complex. And it's not a story that's told in histories of the war. There's just not, even when we write histories of the war in Asia, I mean, my looking for sources, particularly English language sources and sources outside of Vietnam itself, about that aspect of the war is very difficult. There are some historians in Vietnam that I know discuss it, there's not many sources even in, from what I could tell, there's not a great deal of sources in France itself, you know, even though mm-hmm. it was at that point a France colonial possession. You sort of talk about Vietnam later, you know, after the war and what happened with the, communists and the, you know, first independence for Indochina and then the war between, independence for Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia and then the war with the U.S., in the 70s.
So I want to kind of just dwell on that for a moment because you piqued my curiosity because, you know, Vietnam, French colony, and during World War II, Japan invades. And by the way, living in Japan for a while, I got a hearty dose of like right-wing Japanese propaganda mm-hmm. about what quote-unquote actually happened during mm-hmm. World War II. That was a trip. Anyway, Japan goes in, and a lot of the Vietnamese nationalists, including Ho Chi Minh, are actually being supported by the U.S. and such.
Mm-hmm.
What are the French colonial forces doing at the time? Have they just surrendered to the Axis? Are they, like, sitting things out? Are they, like, I'm going to be honest. I've never really thought about what the French colonial forces were doing during World War II.
Well, that's a little unclear, and that's actually the bulk of what Mel was reporting on.
Okay,
you know, because,
all right.
You know, he was in China in June of 1940 when France fell to the Nazis. And there was a lot of, well, dang, what does this mean? Because the, you know, Axis powers had been formed. I don't remember the date. I believe the sort of official formation of the Axis might have been September 1941. I know I've written this. I just, I'm not going to get the date right now.
Hey, I know. Once you write something down, it just exits your head.
But I do remember there was this sense of depression in Chongqing when that happened. And he had been, for example, to the French embassy and knowing what, and kind of that sort of uncertainty of what would happen. That's one reason he went down there, was to sort of see what would play out. There was some brief skirmishing between French forces and the Japanese, and some questions about how many troops Japan could station there. Mm-hmm. And then so there was a lot of movement in terms of who were colonial administrators, who were commanding forces there, and you know whether or not they're sympathetic to the Vichy government, and then a lot of waiting to see what would happen. It was ended up kind of being, I think, 3 or 4 days of skirmishes before there was, I don't know if it was officially a surrender, but a cessation of hostilities. And there was also, and this is the one I understand in less depth, a very brief skirmish between the French and Thailand, between French and China, oh, and Thailand in that area. And Mel went to the front lines to see that. Mm-hmm. And I think that was more of another action. That one I'm not going to try to speak on in too great detail. But the idea was that sort of French, they were sort of left to be. The Japanese just wanted an area that they could station troops for a later, you know, further invasion. Also to, you know, be able to attack supply lines going into China and on into Chongqing and the free parts of China. And that's where it intersects, in fact, with Mel's story, because they were starting to set up guards at, say, like warehouses of oil companies owned by the U.S. Mm-hmm. and trying to restrict oil shipments into China. And another aspect is sort of an increasing sort of strengthening of just sort of like harassment of Western, you know, American, British, other non-French, but European and American business people in the area to sort of make it more difficult for them to connect Free China with their work. I feel a little embarrassed in describing it this way because I'm not remembering it as deeply as I would like. And I know I'm missing details, but I know that Mel wrote a pretty well-regarded piece for Asia Magazine, which was this, you know, monthly magazine put out by, I believe, the Asia Society, but I may be wrong about the exact organization. It was like a 4,000-word piece called How Japan Moved into Indochina that goes into great depth and talks about, actually, I think Ho Chi Minh is mentioned in the story, mm-hmm. and talks about the role that the communists were playing for, because Japan certainly frames some of their involvement as a anti-communist operation, as they do in a lot of the places where they were active. Mel wrote, one of the things that's in my archives, I guess you could say, of his, are literally thousands of pages of like telegrams and dispatches and sort of summaries of every aspect of life in and economics and business and sort of backgrounders on the situation in Vietnam. So mm-hmm. going one set of papers will go in depth on the communists, ones that will go into depth on current military readiness to some degree. Some will go into like just cultural background so that publications back home that he's reporting for will have that kind of understanding as they write. Because that was his priority, is you know, making sure that the story told in the publications he was writing for was more accurate than what he'd first seen in those first years when he was just a student.
Right. You're a journalist. I imagine you have some opinions about journalism.
Mm-hmm.
In what ways was reporting that Jacoby was doing different from the kind of war reporting we would see today? If somebody were to read like AP or, you know, turn on the news or whatnot.
Well, I think in a lot of ways, especially when you look at things like particularly the most recent conflicts in the Middle East and in Ukraine, there's some similarities in terms of no one really knowing, like people trying to get to these war zones and being in danger from every side of the conflict, and some people not having the sort of resource backing they need. You always hear these stories about reporters who need flak jackets or helmets or things like that, or insurance. And, mm-hmm. So enterprising people might get out there and get a story, but then risk, you know, the attention of, if depending how they report it and depending who the audience is of no matter what they say, getting it wrong, you know, in terms of you know, having to be scrutinized on all sides. I think the difference is the some of the reporting, I mean, there's just the chronological difference. You know, there's not the instant reporting capabilities that technology enables. Mm-hmm. There was radio, but then radio would get censored or jammed, or, you know, otherwise you might not have access, you know, when you bring a radio report into the newsroom. You know, in case of Vietnam, there were one of the things Mel complained about was the French censor looking at his work and crossing out, you know, tons of material before he put a script on air, or a telegram that he was going to send out, you know, with his description of some event that had happened. So there's this like censorship combined with the maybe some stories wouldn't get out till a reporter returned to, whether the U.S. or another safer environment. There was the pressure of, angering people with whom you, you know, lived or worked or just saw every day. In Mel's case, when he worked in China, I mentioned that he had been a propagandist for, I mean, I'm using that word a little strongly. He did broadcasts for the national government's radio station. He reported news from Chongqing, but because it was funded by the government, you know, it's kind of technically propaganda. But there was always discussions of, you know, he would get frustrated, and it shows up in his letters, of what was and was not being reported or being allowed to report, or who they did or did not have access to. Those frustrations don't sound much different to me, except for the fact I think we have firmer guidelines on what is available. And like on sort of what is considered acceptable and what is considered not acceptable, partially as a result of the work these people did. I mean, Mel and some other reporters laid the groundwork for what later became known as the Foreign Correspondents Club. It began in among a group of reporters who worked in Chongqing, went to Shanghai after the war, and then after the Chinese Civil War, it ended up in Hong Kong. And that really became sort of the foundation for a lot of foreign correspondents working in Asia that would sort of guide their work throughout the 20th century, and for example in Vietnam. So these people kind of had to cut their own path with this stuff, but you know, there was a lot of reporters sort of making their own rules, a lot more pressure in terms of, you know, from their publication in terms of what to and what not to publish based on political whims. Mm-hmm. Mel's wife and famous presidential biographer, but then reporter Teddy White, you know, worked together to cover China from 1943 to, I think, 1946. I'm also getting those years wrong, but and they were covering the, for example, famines in China, and got incredible blowback from the Chinese government. This is the nationalist Chinese government before mm-hmm. the communists took over, and accusations in the West, in America, of being communist sympathizers. And from there, and got pretty much forced to resign from Time magazine because their work was getting censored when it got sent back to the US. So they had to face all of that kind of over. I mean, I hesitate to say it's different now, because there certainly is a lot of influence on what's published in contemporary media,
just a bit perhaps,
but I think it's like it was more overt then. Mm-hmm. And I don't know which is better, but yeah, as far as being a war reporter, I mean, I've never covered from a conflict myself, so I don't know exactly what's different. Some of the stories I've talked about with people seems very similar. One thing that I think was different, at least in one case, Mel was armed. At one point he was issued a pistol because he pretty credibly had information that there were government agents of the sort of Japanese installed puppet government in China that wanted to kill him. And so he had a pistol that he was issued by someone. And then later when he...
Wait, did you say Japanese installed puppet government? Was this Manchukuo?
Yeah. And well, the Wang Jingwei, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that quite right. The not just Manchukuo, but you know, they were based in Nanjing after mm-hmm. the nationalists withdrew to Chongqing. Mm-hmm. And claimed themselves the full, you know, the legitimate government, but they were... And it was a person who had previously been one of Chiang Kai-shek's, you know, I'm going to get the exact role incorrect, and all the China historians that might happen to hear me are going to like it's cringe, but had worked with Chiang Kai-shek, but then broke when he went to war and decided to side with the communists after Japan invaded in 1937. He became the title of what, you know, what his government official role is, but essentially like was allowed to be there by the Japanese forces who were occupying the, you know, coastal China.
Okay.
And that government sent agents out to kill Mel and other people in Vietnam, mm-hmm. and or in sort of areas that they would have had access to once they went. And he writes a little bit about having thought he saw people following him and things like that. And then the other time they were armed was when they escaped the Philippines, and that was a little more explicit because they were literally going into waters controlled by Japanese and patrolled by Japanese cruisers and submarines and things like that. And had they been captured, they might have been killed. So the U.S. Army issued him and another reporter that was on the trip with like hand grenades and rifles and stuff in case they had to fight their way out of something. I don't think they ever used them, but you wouldn't see a reporter today having a grenade on them, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
You have spent quite a lot of time talking about World War II in Asia.
Yeah.
So I think you maybe know a bit more about it than like the average like World War II history knower.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we were talking about this before we started recording. Yeah. People know all about, you know, the war in the West and all that. What is something about the War of Asia that you wish more people realized?
I mean, that it happened.
Okay.
I didn't know about it before I knew about mm-hmm. Mel. I knew about a lot of stuff about World War II. Yeah, I mean, I'm a white guy in his 40s. I'm like the World War II. I'm a dad.
Me too.
Yeah, I'm the World War II history like demographic, but that's not why I was interested. My dad was really interested in it, and but what I didn't know was that I think it was something like the conflict between Japan and China claimed something like 14,000 lives, but 14 million lives between the most of them in China. But between Japan and China, and that I believe includes civilian deaths. That it was happening for 2 years before Germany invaded Poland, and 4 years before the U.S. Before Pearl Harbor. I think people sort of know about the Flying Tigers, but the fact that the U.S. provided pilots and planes and training for pilots to try to prevent Japanese air raids on the free China portions of China mm-hmm. that were free. And I mean, that other aspect that I already have gone into great depth about the fact that it was happening, you know, I guess just generally that there was fighting happening, you know, in Asia on land as well as in the Pacific. You know, we talk about all the great sea battles and island to island fighting, but there was fighting in China. There was fighting in, in Burma, mm-hmm. in Myanmar now, you know, again, in South Asia and Southeast Asia, in the Philippines, in Malaysia, you know, Singapore. I think the other thing that's big that no one really knows about is that there was a great deal, there were tens of thousands of Jewish refugees who had fled the Nazis mm-hmm. who came to Shanghai. And then, and they had a community and a neighborhood in Shanghai that was very vibrant and very lively during the war. And I think that that's also something that's overlooked about the conflict.
Okay. I have heard about this before, but I don't know the details. Say more about that.
Well, so in the after World War One, I believe this is another one, maybe after the Boxer Rebellion,
mm-hmm.
There were a series of what were known as treaty ports set up by colonial governments in China that were ostensibly Chinese, but were allowing British and French and American and other powers access, sort of unrestricted access to ports in China. Shanghai was, meanwhile, was one of these treaty ports, but it was also what was called, known as an international city. And it was governed by a council of representatives from, I believe the number is something like 20, 22 nations, mostly European,
mm-hmm.
And also the U.S. with each one operating with their own laws intact. Like the U.S. had its own courts in Shanghai for if you broke a law that was an American law in Shanghai, you would be tried by American judges, American juries, and an American court.
Yeah, extraterritoriality.
Extraterritorial. Thank you. There's a term I'm forgetting about. And so while that gave a lot of sort of freedom to colonial powers to exist in their own sort of vision in China, it also meant that Shanghai had a bit of a frontier aspect to it. And, you know, business was almost more important. And there was a sense of freedom that went with that. And in some cases, people saw it as a place to go as refugees. So Shanghai officials allowed in Jewish refugees that had been turned away from ports throughout the world. So people mm-hmm. fleeing the Nazis settled first a few. And then actually Mel wrote one of the first big features about this community that was syndicated in Portland Oregonian and the Los Angeles Times and a lot of other publications talking about what it was like there in the Shanghai ghetto, because he'd gone there in the fall of 1939 with, you know, these big German-speaking neighborhoods. Many of the buildings are still there, at least they were when I visited in 2015. There were synagogues, there were communities, there were schools, there were population, the people brought their businesses, really vibrant life on the streets of, again, I think it was tens of thousands of Jewish people. Not all of them, I mean, most of them were probably refugees, but some were from other countries that had then gone to, you know, build community. There was also a lot of refugees, for example, from the Soviet Union and the sort of constituent republics of the Soviet Union. But most of them were I always think it's strange to say the Shanghai ghetto, because it wasn't as firmly it wasn't as like legally defined, I believe, as like a ghetto in the Nazi, you know, occupied areas. It's just an area of the city that was where Jews were allowed to live and Chinese nationals were allowed to live, because some of the other areas of the city were only allowed to live if you were a citizen of any of these, you know, countries. There's the American quarter and the Japanese, I mean, the French quarter and the, you know, that sort of the French concession and all that.
Yeah.
So that became, you know, sort of a space that was a thriving community. I don't know exactly their fate during the war. I mean, after 1941, I can't recall how. There's been plenty of history, plenty of good history of this. At the moment, I'm like drawing a blank on exactly, you know, what happened to them during the duration of the conflict. I know lots of Westerners were confined to internment camps by Japanese officials, but I don't know if the same was true of these Jewish refugees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. God, now I feel like we need to do an entire episode on just that.
And this book includes pictures of that neighborhood and you know, signage in, you know, in Yiddish and German, and people just, you know, a dentist, for example, with like it's a great photo of a Chinese kid and Jewish kid holding hands outside of a dentist's office there. You know, it's just like really telling. Yeah.
Let's talk about the book. Where can people find it? When can people find it?
So people can find it on March 26th in North America. It's already out in Hong Kong. But in North America and Europe and the UK, it's March 26th. It's everywhere you can get books. Bookshop.org is always my preferred bet, because you can order any book you want there online and it'll support indie bookstores. You can get it at other very big book retailer people. You get it from my website, lasherlarge.com. If you're in Portland, I'm going to be at the Rose City Book Pub for a launch event on March 30th. And I'm planning events in Seattle and at least one online event, quote unquote, in Beijing, except for I will be here, but it'll be a remote event. I'm not 100% sure if that's open to the public. It's with the Royal Asiatic Society of Beijing, but I'm not sure if it's only open to their members or not. So I'll have to find out. But that'll be on April, I believe it's April 3rd.
All right. Awesome. Bill Lasher, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you all for listening. Thank you again to Bill Lasher for coming on the show. One last thing, a word on social media. Like a lot of people, I have taken a step back from social media and reevaluated my relationship to it. I think I speak for a lot of people when I say that being on it a lot is, you know, not great. So I am on Facebook far less now. And by far less, I mean barely. I don't really post show episodes or updates on the Weird History Facebook podcast at all. Also, Twitter, well, Twitter has been murdered, so I still have a Twitter account, but I do not use it. The only thing you'll find on my Twitter account is a pinned tweet directing you to my link tree, which directs you elsewhere. The one social media account I am on with any regularity is Blue Sky. So if you want to find me on the internet, that's where I am nowadays. And I post about things like parenthood and horror movies, you know, things very important to me and resonant with me. If you like those things, you should follow me at Joe Streckert on Blue Sky. Once again, thank you all for listening. Talk to you next time. Bye. Can you come a little bit closer?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. This is.
I think we're good.
Okay.
All right. Now we're going to act like we just started having a conversation.
All right.
All right.